Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Are you doing field stuff right now? Are you going out on boats?
I wish. I used to go and do a lot of field work and do work on oceanographic vessels. And these days I sit with my computer and I analyze data and I write papers. Mm-hmm. But my mind gets to travel all over the place.
Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with Sarah Myrie, an oceanographer and climate scientist at the University of Washington.
Well, so I had garnered a degree of attention after I published my PhD, and so I had like currency and like a bit of a public eye. That was fine and good, and I got to talk about climate change and oceanography and marine ecology, but then the Me Too movement happened, and that really broke pieces inside me where I had to come to terms. So I came to the table then and wrote pieces in Newsweek and in The Stranger about my experiences as a scientist with harassment and sexual assault and rape. Those things catalyzed a shift inside of me to begin to be brave enough to talk about these really, really hard pieces that are a component of my professional life as a scientist.
What was it like then, making the decision to write about it so publicly and then actually doing it?
You know, at the time I had finished working with a really amazing student. I was shepherding her career and I was in a place of thinking of how terrible it would be if something happened to her like it had happened to me. It brought it to a place where I could no longer be silent because I really felt a responsibility to the safety and the stewardship of the careers of these young people. So that was the machinery inside of me that forced a shift to come forward.
So how would you describe the response?
I get harassed all the time on the internet. I get weird emails. I get hate mail. And the majority of that is in line with a lot of what other women scientists also receive. So this is just a phenomenon that people that are in my position experience, but it's a ton of hate. The response has been amazing from other women in science. It's been remarkable. And not to put myself in any like self-inflating position, but I think I played an important role in initiating the now sort of community-wide efforts to stop the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health from funding known harassers. So now we are pushing into the institutions around us to say, you're not a good scientist if you sexually harass and assault people. You don't get to participate in the community. So this is how we build a safer, more inclusive community, right? Is to say, it matters when people are victimized and we can do better.
Sarah Myrie, she's a research associate at the University of Washington and, these days, an activist. On today's show, it's stories of the squeaky wheel, people who chose to speak up even when it would be so much easier not to. That's all on this week's Sound Effect from KNKX. When she was growing up, Cece Moore really wanted to go to law school or become a journalist. But in a strange twist of parental expectations, her family pressured her to pursue acting. And for years, she did musical theater and commercials, but she never really got rid of that investigative bug.
When I was little, I made my mom buy me every Nancy Drew book in the series, which was like over 100. And I look back and laugh at that a little bit now because I never had the intention or even the thought to go into law enforcement.
Eventually, Moore found a new passion to pursue, one that would bring her closer to those detective stories than she ever could have imagined. These days, Cece Moore helps catch killers. This began, innocently enough, with a little amateur genealogy.
my niece was getting married, and I thought it would be a good wedding present to give her a family tree. I thought I could just throw one together, package it up nice, give it to her for her wedding. I got a little obsessed. It just started as a hobby. But when I saw the potential of it, I kind of dropped everything else I was doing. I barely knew what a blog was, but, you know, it was easy to start one. And so I started writing up the research I was finding in my own family, and I was just amazed at the readership I was getting. People started coming to me for help with their research. In particular, people that had found out that their father was not their biological father because they had taken a DNA test. And adoptees also were asking me, do you think you could use these methodologies you've been creating and this data to help me find my birth parents or my birth grandparents in some case? We've seen tens of thousands of people find their family and have happy reunions. Doesn't always turn out happily, but the vast majority of the time it does. And although I respect the privacy of birth parents who don't want to have a relationship, I still believe very strongly that everybody deserves to know where they come from. Everyone has the right to their biological heritage. They don't necessarily have a right to a relationship with their birth parents or birth families. That's everyone's personal choice. But as a genealogist, I just felt very strongly that everyone has that right to learn about where they came from, and I mean genetically where they came from. And so I thought I would go about helping to right what I saw as a societal wrong. So yeah, you spit in that tube and send it in to Ancestry DNA or 23andMe. And if you opt in to matching, then they will compare you to everyone else who's already in that database. And that has helped us resolve so many people's family mysteries. Most of what I do is still manual. I am looking at that list of matches. That's what's important here. And we're hoping to find someone who is a second cousin or closer. So I'm looking at the top of that list, who shares the most DNA, and then what I'm looking at is their family tree, trying to figure out where this adoptee or this suspect fits. And that is the same methodologies that eventually ended up being used for the Golden State Killer arrest.
Police say they now have the Golden State Killer in custody.
And they use DNA testing to find him. So many families are relieved this morning.
In April of 2018, Joseph James DeAngelo was arrested for a string of unsolved murders in California. Law enforcement officials had had the idea of comparing DNA from a crime scene with DNA from people who took one of those commercial tests. They connected the dots and made an arrest. And all of a sudden, the methods that CeCe Moore had been using to unite family members were getting all kinds of new attention.
So because I had worked a lot of high-profile cases, I had been contacted quite a few times over the last few years by law enforcement personnel, by detectives or district attorneys, coroners, people who thought outside the box, who saw what I was doing and said, is this applicable to identification in law enforcement cases? And I knew that there was potential for that, but it was something that I declined to do until recently. And GEDmatch was the only possibility, but it was too small for a long time. Until recently, that database would have been too small to get anywhere on these cases.
And that's another company that does similar kind of work?
So GEDmatch isn't exactly a company. They're not a DNA testing company, I should say. You don't send your DNA in and it gets tested. They are a repository for raw data files from the DNA companies. So if you've tested at Ancestry DNA or 23andMe or one of the other companies like that, you can download a raw data file that contains your DNA signature. And you can choose to upload that to GEDmatch, which is a public database. And that's the only time that we would be using your DNA for law enforcement purposes. In fact, I can explain it a little bit with the Snohomish County case, the Jay Cook and Tanya Van Culenberg case.
Investigators in Washington State are pushing hard tonight for a breakthrough in a cold case murder that has been unsolved for more than two decades.
So this was a case where it was a double murder. It was a young Canadian couple that had come down into Washington State to do an errand for one of their fathers, and they never made it home. And the woman was found sexually assaulted and murdered. And in a different place, the male was found murdered brutally. And this was over 30 years ago. And so this person that committed this crime had been, you know, getting away with this for decades.
Investigators did have a sample of the killer's DNA. So they plugged it into the database, and waited for CeCe Moore to do her work.
They uploaded it on a Friday night, and I woke up Saturday morning to the matches. It takes, you know, between about 8 hours and 2 days to get a list of matches. And I could see right away it was a really promising case. We had two people that shared about enough DNA with the unknown suspect to be second cousins. I identify who these matches are based on the information that's provided in GEDmatch, and then I build their family trees back to great-grandparents. Because if you're second cousins, you share your great-grandparents. And then we have to flip the tree upside down and do what I called reverse genealogy. Instead of trying to find dead people, we're now trying to find living people who descend from these sets of great-grandparents in each of the trees. So as I started building forward in time from these identified great-grandparents, I found one person from one tree who married a person from the other tree. So a descendant of the first match's great-grandparents and a descendant of the second match's great-grandparents married. And when I looked at this family structure, I realized they only had one son. So that one son would be carrying that correct mix of ancestral DNA to be the unknown suspect. And by Monday, I could provide the detectives with his name, which was William Earl Talbot II. So then they have to build the case. They can't go arrest someone based on what I tell them, of course. I'm just providing a highly scientific tip. So they did great work. They started surveilling him, and they had to follow him, from what I understand, for quite a while until they were able to pick up a discarded cup and get that discarded DNA, which they are legally allowed to test. And they got an exact match. And so that gave them what they needed to be able to arrest him, which they then did.
And was he convicted?
Oh, it hasn't gone to trial yet. This is still so new. I've only been doing work with law enforcement for 3.5 months. We've had 7 arrests. So it's moved fast, but nothing has made it to trial yet. We still have a long way to go. People ask me all the time, how does this feel when you realize you found the person, or you think you have found the person, I should say. And it's not like it is with adoption, because with adoption, I know that there's a really good chance for a happy ending, that they'll be welcomed by at least one family member. And in these, I know there's no happy endings. You know, the damage is done. The victim is already gone in most places, or extremely damaged in others. There's no going back. The families have been affected forever. I guess my greatest hope is that this could work as a deterrent. Some people who might act in passion, maybe if they just thought for a moment, that it's getting easier to get caught. There are going to be less and less cold cases out there because we're going to be able to resolve dozens or hundreds of these over the next months and years. And so I do hope that it might cause someone to stop and think and say, well, you know what? I better not do this. Maybe that'll save lives, both on the side of the victim and of the perpetrator. Everyone would always say to me, you know, one day everything you've done will make sense. And so now it does kind of all make sense, but I could never have imagined it would lead here. I really felt my life's work was helping adoptees and others of unknown parentage. So this is almost come full circle back to my Nancy Drew days.
CeCe Moore is a genetic genealogist based in California. When she's not helping solve murders, she consults as an expert on the PBS series, Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates Jr. This is Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer here, and our theme this week is Squeaky Wheel. Now a place where you're supposed to be a squeaky wheel, in the hospital. Experts say it's important to be your own advocate as a patient, and that goes double when you're the parent of a sick child. So what does that feel like from a doctor's point of view? Well, Sam Blackman is a cancer researcher and a former pediatric oncologist in Seattle. He shares this story of two assertive parents and the lessons they taught him.
I was a pediatric resident at a well-respected hospital in the Midwest, and To get in, I had taken a lot of tests. I had a lot of confidence. I mean, I walked in there with two doctoral degrees, right? My medical degree and a PhD in pharmacology. And to be a pediatric resident and to not have children is an interesting thing because you are a textbook expert on children as a population, but you have essentially no expertise in parenting or in that parent's child. During residency, it's typically 1 month long block rotations throughout all of the subspecialties of whatever it is that you're looking to practice. So for pediatrics, it was a month in neonatal intensive care unit and a month on pediatric surgery and a month on, you know, general pediatrics. And there was a mother of a patient on the cardiology service, and we were all terrified of this mother. Mrs. G, oh, Mrs. G. She was a night owl. So she would either be gone during the day working or she'd be asleep, and we'd round and we'd make the plan. But at night, she would be up and she would like read the chart. She'd read the progress notes that we would write about what was going on during the day. And if she saw something that she didn't like, she would have the nurse page the resident on call who'd have to come and talk to her. And if you're on call every third night or every fourth night, like your goal is to keep everything quiet so you can get some sleep. One night, I was asleep, and the nurse paged me because Mrs. G wanted to talk to the resident. You know, I get out of bed, my call room, and I drag myself down the hall onto the ward into her room, and she's up. And honestly, to this day, I can't remember specifically what the concern was. I just remember thinking to myself, now you're just torturing me. Like, there's nothing here that's going to change what I'm going to do right now. There's no acute emergency. And I told her, like, whatever it is that you're concerned about, I'm not seeing. We'll keep an eye on it. And if anything changes, I'm just down the hall sleeping. And I was so tired. I left the room. And at that point, I lost it. And I turned to the nurse who had paged me, and I yelled at her out loud. And I said, don't you dare call me again unless that kid is coding. And Mrs. G was 10 feet away and the doors open and she heard what I said. I look back over that episode now and I know what my mistakes were. And the biggest mistake that I made was not recognizing that not only was Mrs. G's child's heart diseased and broken, but Mrs. G's heart was broken, that she didn't know what was going to happen to her child. She didn't know if he was going to get better or not. And she was trapped in that hospital room, like her child was trapped in that hospital room. And what she needed was me to be a doctor for her as well. And what I wasn't seeing were the symptoms of her broken heart. And it changed the way that I took care of patients from that day forward. And I recognized that if I was feeling like that, it wasn't that the parent was doing something wrong, it's I was being tested. I think I was substantially better by the time I started my oncology fellowship and really dramatically changed the types of relationships that I had with parents of children with cancer going forward, because I would never, ever feel satisfied until I felt that I had heard everything that I needed to hear, because I knew that sometimes the words as they were being spoken weren't the message, it was what was underneath, and sometimes it just took time to find that. I was doing a rotation through the oncology service, and there was a little girl who had, without a doubt, one of the worst brain tumors ever that you can have. Almost uniformly fatal. 95-98% of children die from that disease. This little girl, who I'll call Brianna, her mother was a single mom, and she just wanted no part of the care team. She would not even let us into the room because she just didn't see the point, because she knew that the diagnosis was devastating and that the outcome was going to be fatal. We we'd stand outside of the door and we'd talk about the child in the abstract. But there were times when Brianna's mother would come out of the room when she wanted to try her own things. She was very much into alternative modes of therapy. She came to us one day because she wanted to give Brianna daily coffee enemas. Turns out that there's this alternative therapy called Gerson therapy. It's not ever been shown to be effective in any way, shape, or form, and it's really sort of a fringe thing in the medical literature, but it involved daily coffee enemas. And so I went back and I talked to Brianna's mother and I laid out what I had found. And by taking her seriously and actually engaging her as an adult and listening to her, she actually began to let me into the room. And then I would come out and I'd tell the team what I found. And for a while, I was exclusively the only person she would let, besides the nurses, the only person she'd let into the room. And I was basically her personal doctor. But, you know, rotations don't go on forever. And at the end of the month, I moved on to the next thing. You know, I think about that time, about how you walk out of the situation where you're a master at taking tests, great at filling in the bubbles. You've got a sheaf of number two pencils at the ready at all times. And then you're in the situation, being a doctor, taking care of patients, where you're tested and sometimes you don't even know what the questions are, let alone the answers, or you don't even recognize that you're being tested. I never got a chance to apologize to Mrs. G. Mrs. G was a great teacher. She taught me a lesson that I needed to learn. Brianna's mother was a great teacher for me because she taught me what happens if you actually pass that test. I was out to dinner one night with my wife, and I was coming home, and my pager went off, and it was from a part of the hospital where the palliative care patients go, patients at the end of their lives. And the nurse said, I know you're not on call, and I know you're not even on service, but it looks like Brianna is going to die tonight. Would you like to come in? And so I dropped my wife off at home and I went back to the hospital. Dying is a process from a disease like a brain tumor, and it is not an easy process. You don't just stand there as a physician, you actually try to work to alleviate symptoms and pain. But it takes a long time because while the tumor in the brain is shutting down higher order functions in the brain, the heart and the lungs of an 8-year-old are like, well, wait a second, I'm like only 8 years old, and they are strong and they keep going. And it's heartbreaking to say, and it's heartbreaking to think about, and it's heartbreaking to watch. We just had to do what doctors for a long time have done, which is to just be present, to bear witness. And at some point in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, Brianna had stopped breathing. And so I went into the room, and Brianna's mother's in there, and then Brianna is lying in her bed, and I did what you're supposed to do. You feel for a pulse. You put your stethoscope on the chest and you listen for a full 60 seconds to ensure the absence of a heartbeat and respiration. And you make note of the time of death. And as I was leaving the room, I said to Brianna's mother, I said, I'm so sorry for your loss. Is there anything that I can do for you? And she said, can you pray with me? And so I'm like a secular Jew from New Jersey, and I was not the praying type. I didn't really believe in God at that point. And I also felt that it was weird, and I was really questioning, like, should I be pretending to pray over a newly dead child? Like, I'm in my head, I'm thinking about me. But then I realized that Brianna's mother needed me to do this, and she needed me to be the doctor that she had seen me as for the past number of months. And so I went back, and she and I held hands, and we stood at Brianna's bedside. And she closed her eyes, and so I closed my eyes. And then she started speaking, and she happened to say the one non-Jewish prayer that I actually knew. And she said, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven."
Sam Blackwell is a physician and researcher in Seattle, where he's also a regular at live storytelling events. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect from KNKX. In the small hours of April 2nd in 2001, a 92-foot trawler called the Arctic Rose was swallowed up by the Bering Sea. The Seattle-based crew of 15 went down with it, and it was called the deadliest fishing accident in 50 years. There was no mayday call, no survivors, and no obvious reason for this terrible tragedy. A Coast Guard investigation came up with its most likely scenario, that the crew had mistakenly left a watertight door open, allowing waves to swamp the boat. But that never sat right with Bob Ford. Ford was an investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board, and he developed his own explanation for what likely happened, which he then sat on for 14 years. Finally, in 2015, a by-now-retired Bob Ford decided to become a squeaky wheel.
Because I just said, hey, this could be the last gasp, the last chance to get the truth out, or at least to get another assessment out, because the family members are sitting back thinking the reason why their family members, their loved ones died, was because they left a back door open. Even one of the media outlets got a bunch of all the surviving closest relatives in a room and, you know, taped them and interviewed them. And Mikey's sister said, you know, the sad part is they did this to himself by leaving that door open. And when I saw, I just groaned and said, oh no, that's not why this happened.
Before we go on, we need to do a quick review of some maritime vocabulary. Port.
Left.
Starboard.
Right.
Stern.
Back.
Keel.
The spine of a ship's bottom.
And trawl.
To drag a fishing net through deep water.
Got it? Okay, so back to Bob Ford and why he decided to go public with his minority report.
The Coast Guard truly believed that they must have been sleeping on the Arctic Rose. And I wasn't ready or willing to just blindly accept that and say, well, okay. So that was one of the first bones of contention, if you want to put it that way, just something I disagreed with. I wanted a lot more proof of that.
Could you kind of summarize the Coast Guard's interpretation of events and what they concluded about the most likely cause of the sinking?
The Coast Guard basically felt that a front came through. The winds kicked up to easily exceeding 45 knots. The seas are going to kick up. They feel, because of the position of the rudder, that a sea came over. They looked at the ROV video and said the door was open on the stern.
ROV is a remote operated vehicle, so like an underwater camera?
Correct. And I look at this and I'm going, wait a second. You're telling me that's the door? If you're saying that's the door, you're saying it's hinged to port. Well, the door on the Arctic Rose was hinged to starboard. And so what they pointed out of their smoking gun just didn't smoke to me. Now, you have to realize at this point, I had been taken off the investigation. Before they even sent the ROV down, the director of the office said, we have too many other issues, too many other investigations, we're too small an office, and I'm going to have to pull you off. We'll wait till see what the Coast Guard comes up with. So at this point, I'm working under the table, so to speak, or behind the scenes, or whatever term you want to use.
Why is that, Bob? Why not just say, okay, time to move on?
I mean, something I've asked myself that question, and I've gotten so involved in the investigation at this point. I was not comfortable some of the things I felt the Coast Guard were saying and possibly the direction they were heading. I've asked myself that question a number of times. Why didn't I just let it go? I don't know. Same thing when they found the part of the remains of Jeff Mahnke.
Well, after the fact, as you alluded to, they did recover a portion of, you know, the remains of one of the crew members. What happened there, and how did that land with you?
Well, what had happened was, I believe this was in 2015, early 2015 or late 2014. I go on the Seattle Times and front page this story about the recovery of remains of the youngest on the boat, and a picture of Jeff Mahnke and his mother. I couldn't believe it. It was almost like, this can't be true. This can't be accurate. This is like a one in a billion chance, with as big as the Pacific Ocean is, and one trawler scoops up a bunch of fish and remains of Jeff Mahnke comes up. It's almost like I felt, you know what? It sounds like the dead on the Arctic Rose are not resting in peace, and somehow he found his way to speak out.
How did you begin developing your own picture of what you think happened?
Once again, I had to do this on the sly, by this point, I had a new immediate supervisor, and he saw a box come in from the Coast Guard of additional information, and he says, "What is this?" And I go, "It's the Arctic Rose." And at first, I was going to say, "Well, I'm trying to stop the Coast Guard from sending it," but I said, "No, I'm not lying to the guy." I said, "I'm still working on it on my own time." And he goes, "Just don't let the director find out." So I just kept basically working on it on my own time. I don't know how many times I looked at that ROV video. And I just would drive home, and sometimes I'm thinking, what am I missing? What am I missing? And that's where the whole issue of the oil slick came from. Boats, ships that sink quickly and just flip over and go down, based on their scenario, which is what happened to the Arctic Rose, don't leave 5 mile oil slicks.
So what was your scenario?
I think the trawl doors, which would have been pulled in to the outboard side of the boat, broke loose, came around and hit the fuel tank, the day tank, which provides fuel to the engine. So you got water in the fuel, engine dies, you have the battery room flooded, and now you have no VHF radios to make a call. So now you have also oil leaking, front flooding, no propulsion, and they just went down. And I would almost bet they went down bow first and did almost a somersault and landed on their keel.
Do you think you would have done anything differently if you had it to do over again?
I've asked myself that too. And I have to say, I don't think so. I mean, I didn't go into the NTSB with an attitude, I'm going to be the Sherlock Holmes of the NTSB and marine investigations. For me to have remained at the NTSB, I would have had to have basically swallowed certain beliefs. And I just, there's no way I was going to do that.
Bob Ford is a retired investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board. He lives in Virginia. The Coast Guard has said it stands by its investigation. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is Squeaky Wheel. The plan for Nathan Myhrvold was to go into academia. He had his PhD in physics and had even done some work with Stephen Hawking. But then he got pulled into this side project. The project turned into a company. The company got acquired by a little Redmond concern called Microsoft. And before long, Nathan became Microsoft's first chief technology officer. But Myhrvold kept his passion for science. And while he was at Microsoft, in his abundant free time, he started writing papers about dinosaurs.
Everybody loves dinosaurs when they're a kid. And professional paleontologists are just people who never lost that. So don't ask me why I'm interested. It's like, what happened to you?
I met Myhrvold at the Bellevue headquarters of his current company, Intellectual Ventures. His office is littered with dinosaur fossils and space rocks. He wears jeans and a t-shirt that says, "Pizza is beautiful." He may not be a professional scientist, but he's got a track record of confronting the pros when he finds flaws in their work. And that led me to my impolite first question, why be such a pain in the butt to mainstream science?
I would say I'm not a pain in the butt to mainstream science. You know, in the case of dinosaurs, I've published many papers on dinosaurs, and I was well enough established that at the annual conference where all the dinosaur paleontologists go, I knew pretty much everybody, not totally, but pretty much. Now, I did discover that there was a series of papers on dinosaur growth rates where the people who had done the studies had cooked the books. They cheated. Okay, they made data up. They did a variety of other things. It was clear case of scientific misconduct. There were lots of other paleontologists that suspected this guy either was wrong or had really screwed things up, but they were reticent to bring it up. And that's because this guy had attained a certain amount of stature. When you have someone who has attained a high degree of stature in the field, it's very difficult to come back and say, wait a minute, this person cheated. In this dinosaur case, another paleontologist came up to me after it was all published, and he said, you know, I knew that there was something wrong with it, but if I asked a graduate student to work on that, it'd be like asking him to walk into a buzzsaw.
So what is it about you, do you think, that made you not leave it alone?
Well, I asked this guy, and he said, I don't have tenure yet. This guy would block my tenure. There's no way I could do it. Whereas me, I have tenure at Nathan University. You know, I don't have an academic job.
How is it similar to and how does it differ from what came up later with the NASA data?
In that case, some people who wanted to build a space telescope to find asteroids that could hit Earth came to see me hoping I would give them some money or I would endorse their project to various rich friends of mine. And I got interested in what they said, and I started doing some calculations. Well, as part of that, I discovered one of those projects, a proposed project, had made a colossal error in their physics. They had forgotten something called Kirchhoff's law. Now, this is a first-year college physics kind of a thing. In fact, good high school physics covers it. But they had screwed it up. I contacted them, and this project had talked to me almost every day. Well, as soon as I asked about this and about their previous project, which was a NASA project that was largely completed, which had tried to estimate the size of 150,000 or so asteroids, well, I discovered they made that mistake there too. So these people were estimating the size of asteroids. Now, the way you check to see if that's correct is there's a small set of asteroids where we know the diameter some other way. So what you're supposed to do is take the asteroids that we know the diameter of a different way and now compare your estimates. Instead, they had copied the diameters of those ones we knew exactly. This is a group which is very famous in the field. The NASA program office that they're associated with is the main funding source for asteroids. And I think the similarity is just as the dinosaur guy was a total jerk about using peer review and other things to threaten people, this group did the same thing. When my first paper on this came out, I got several emails from people. One said, you know, welcome to the club of people who this group is, NEOWISE group, has tried to squelch.
Is this something that's like part of your personality or your intellectual kind of constitution that that you persist doggedly when you've got a bone like this?
Well, mostly, you know, in asteroids, I'm doing lots of other work because I've gotten into it now. And that work isn't about correcting other people's mistakes. It's about just taking brand new ideas. And in dinosaurs, I had published many papers on dinosaurs prior to those growth rate studies, and I've published a bunch since that weren't about that. They were about other things. So I don't know what combination of things caused these to come my way, but it is true that once they did come my way, and once I saw the bad behavior, I wasn't going to let it go. And the more that they tried intimidation, the more I knew I had to be correct, because they'd use a real argument if they didn't have to try intimidation. And part of transparency is you have to be able to investigate stuff. And if it's unspeakable to say that a scientist cheated, guess what? You're going to have more cheaters than if it's speakable. Science is supposed to be idealistic. And if it isn't idealistic, it's nothing. And that idealism includes when you find a clear case of cheating, you have to call it out. So I certainly don't look for examples in science where this occurs. But I'm also not going to look the other way.
Nathan Mervold is the CEO of Intellectual Ventures based in Bellevue and also an amateur physicist and paleontologist, photographer, and cookbook author. His paper on asteroids was published in the journal Icarus. In a written statement, the NASA team disputed several of Mervold's claims about their asteroid research. They said they used a widely accepted model that got similar results to the one Nathan favors, and they reject the idea that they froze him out, noting they responded to, quote, dozens of requests for information over a year. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Squeaky Wheel. This hour, we've been hearing from people who have a need to speak up and be heard. But this next story we're about to hear deals with actual squeaks and rips and chips and lots of other busted things. It's a mobile repair shop that pops up at libraries around King County. It's called a Fix-It Fair, or a Repair Cafe. And yes, lots of lamps and old stereos and clothing get fixed, but these events also give people from all different walks of life a chance to just hang out with each other. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing paid a visit to a repair event at the Skyway Library near Renton.
In the library's parking lot, there's a pop-up workshop. Paul Savino, a retired chemistry professor from Federal Way, and I warn you, a jokester, has bins full of Allen wrenches, batteries, and lots of shiny little objects that hold things together.
People say I'm nuts, but it's just washers.
But I'm fine. Paul is one of the many fixers who are here to help people put their broken things back together, just as long as it doesn't involve gasoline.
Well, you know, they frown on blowing up the libraries. So no gasoline, but anything that can be picked up and carried in. We did an Indian spice grinder. We did a three-wheel bicycle, a bed frame, vacuum cleaners, blenders. I've seen the guys put in new screens on smartphones, and we try to keep everything out of the landfill if we can.
A little girl, 9-year-old Enid Rauschenberg, walks up to Paul. She pulls a few soft items out of a bag and lays them on the work table.
Let's see what you've got.
Okay, so I have two things.
One is a fancy hairband with sequins that are unraveling, and the other is a small slipper in the shape of a cat.
Her little nose came off.
Oh, no. She still stinks, but she doesn't smell. Is that...
Okay.
Okay, enough bad jokes.
For this fix, Paul finds just the right type of glue to reattach the cat's pink nose.
Is that super glue?
It is.
I've gotten super glue stuck to me before and it is not fun.
The big problem is making sure that the nose doesn't stick to me. How's that?
I think that's perfect.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. This is all set to go.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I will probably see you later.
Oh, I would hope so. Come back with something else that's broken.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
With that, Enid walks away a happy customer, and Paul holds on to that satisfying feeling you get when you know that you've helped another person.
No matter how unimportant the piece of material is that I'm fixing at any given moment, to that person, that repair is worth its weight in gold.
In the world we live in today, if a toaster breaks, or those comfy sweatpants you bought for cheap from the markdown rack get a rip in them, most of us would probably toss them. Replacing things quickly with a tap on our phones or clicks on a keyboard, it's so easy to do. And that's why what's going on at these repair events feels kind of radical. People are forced to slow down, explain what's wrong with whatever it is that they brought in, and hang out for a while to see if it can be saved. And all of the work is done for free. Now we go from Paul's workshop in the Skyway Library parking lot to a room inside the library that's normally reserved for quiet meetings and story hours. It's packed. Lamps are being taken apart. The guts of an old reel-to-reel tape player are on a table. There's a row of sewing machines. Women are sealing up holes and pants. Frayed scarves are getting hemmed. And an electric blue flamenco skirt called a bata de cola is being worked on by seamstress Catherine Etchison.
She caught her heel in one of the ruffles and pulled it off, so I'm sewing it back on for her.
The costume belongs to 67-year-old Annie Galarosa.
Flamenco, it comes from the gypsy people of southern Spain. They were a people that for many years have been oppressed.
To Annie, whose family is originally from the Philippines, this skirt means so much more than a type of dance.
To me, it represents freedom, you know, and anybody who's ever felt any oppression, I don't care what color you are, know that there's sometimes you go somewhere to be able to express your freedom, whether it's dancing or writing poetry or riding a motorcycle out in the country.
Seamstress Catherine Etchison returns the heavy skirt to Annie with the ruffle fully attached.
Yeah, we got it all sewn up. I couldn't find out how to get into it.
Well, I appreciate what you did. I will model it for you.
Annie puts on the skirt to show everyone how it looks.
Oh, my goodness!
Oh, it's beautiful. At the end of the afternoon, the flamenco skirt was added to the list of things that were repaired on this particular day. Out of the 59 objects that people brought in, 46 of them were mended or fixed.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer Wing and Kevin Kniestad with Bethany Denton. We had help this week from Janae Janik, Monica Spain, Max Hendricks, and Paul Currington. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. I hope you'll take a second to subscribe to our now twice weekly podcast. Find us on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you access that sort of thing. And that includes your smart speaker. Just say, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." We're back next week with Tales of the Folly of Youth. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.